All right, are we doing this? Are we, Scott? If you don't start in the next 5 minutes, I'm gonna stay here because I am committed to this.
Hi, and welcome to Brought to the Table. Today we have Diana Schulberg, Ian Walker, Carter, Caitlin Phillips, and me, Scott Pruitt. This is a podcast where a group of friends, we come together, we're going to share some stuff with each other and hopefully share some stuff with you. So the two groups we have today are Diana and Ian, and on the other side will be Carter and Caitlin.
Now, I have a question just already. Why didn't I get a last name?
Because you don't have a last name.
That's fair. Okay. Sorry, Scott.
I don't even know where I was anymore.
You just shared what the format was. Oh, you know, you just told us what the groups were. I can edit this.
Today, I'm the host, so I will be freeloading and not preparing any topics. So to decide who goes first, I've got a very interesting trivia question.
Yay!
Of course, everybody here is familiar with the greatest game console ever released, the Nintendo GameCube.
Yes. Of course.
All right, well, I'll fight you on that one, but continue.
We all know that the best-selling game for the Nintendo GameCube is Super Smash Bros. Melee. But what is the best-selling game for the Nintendo GameCube that does not feature a character from the Mario universe nor the Zelda universe?
I mean, I'm going to say Pikmin because I'm obsessed with Pikmin, but I don't think that's actually the answer.
You are wrong.
Is it Metroid Prime?
You're very close.
Is it Metroid... whatever the one that's not
Metroid
Prime is.
Metroid Prime is the one after this game.
I don't know my Metroid series, man. That was a shot
it's
in
not,
the dark.
No, it's not a Metroid game. It's the next best-selling game.
Oh, dang.
Donkey Kong?
And there was no Donkey Kong.
Wii Sports.
That also doesn't make any sense.
Because it's a Wii, Diana, not on GameCube.
Shit, this is hard.
Is it Animal Crossing?
It is Animal Crossing.
Shit, that's good.
Sold about 3 million copies. So the order is Melee, Double Dash, Sunshine, Wind Waker, Luigi's Mansion, surprisingly, Animal Crossing, Metroid Prime.
So who got that right?
Caitlin.
Okay, nice. We go first.
So Caitlin and I guess Carter, what are you sharing today?
You guess.
I mean, I think I got it right, so I should just talk uninterrupted for 15 minutes straight without taking a breath.
All right, I'm out. I've got a green apron to cook.
A blapron, if you will.
A grapron.
A grapron. We are going to talk about the album Modern Vampires of the City by the band Vampire Weekend.
So Vampire Weekend is a band. It's, I don't know, they've been around for not a terribly long time. Well, I'm a liar. It's about 10 years, I think, since their first album came out. They're an indie pop band. This album that we're specifically talking about right now, Modern Vampires of the City, came out in 2013, so 5 years ago. But that being said, it is their most recent album. Before that, their last album was Contra, released in 2010. Easily one of my top five bands of all time. They're just real good. But the band itself, they're a bunch of East Coast people. They're based in New York. They all met each other in while they were students at Columbia, and their sound sounds like it. They're definitely a bunch of pretentious Columbia grads, or at least they were when they started.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because in their first album, they kind of leaned into it. That's where Campus came from, that song that everyone knows. Then Contra and this album, they're kind of growing up a little bit, but you can still be like, Ivy League East Coast flavor, huh? Still bringing it. Okay.
You know, you mentioned Campus, but I do actually want to play just a little bit of two songs by Vampire Weekend. First, I'm going to play Diane Young, which is one of their big hits off of the album. I think it was their first single off the album.
I'm digging the jaunty beat.
So that was Diane Young, and next I'll cue up a little bit of Step For You, which is another one of the singles off of the album. New York with champagne and disco, tapes from LA / San Francisco, but actually Oakland and Alameda, your girls in Berkeley with a communist reader, man was in tune with a boombox and Walkman,
was a horrible girl that was back then. Oh, this is vastly different. Interesting.
Yeah, well, that's kind of why we picked out those two songs.
I know nothing about this band, so I didn't realize they were right away from... Are they from the same album?
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about one album right now.
That's a very big split.
Yeah, like, not only are these off of one album, these are two songs that come one after the other. I actually played them for you in reverse order, but Step plays and then Diane Young plays immediately after that. And that really kind of leads me into something that I really enjoy about this album. It is, in reading Ezra's interviews, Ezra Koenig, the frontman for Vampire Weekend, he had some interviews when this album came out sort of discussing how the album was created and what they wanted to do with it. And one of the things that was very important to him, and I think really shows throughout the album, is that each song had to have its own identity and own purpose within the album while still contributing to the album as a whole, as one conformed piece of art. And I think that he absolutely succeeded with that. And not only does each one have its own identity, it flows very well throughout the album. You know, you've got a pretty slow start with a song called Obvious Bicycle, which leads into a very religiously toned song called Unbelievers, which then goes into Step, and then goes into Diane Young. And then it's got these ups and downs. You know, it doesn't take the Tom Haverford tact of all climax all the time. You know, it doesn't.
It follows what, you know, balanced albums do more or less, which is alternating between faster and slower to, you know, keep you engaged.
Yeah, for sure. And but one thing that I think that a lot of albums fall into a trap with, to point out a few examples of this, the most recent Gorillaz album, Humans, and AM by Arctic Monkeys. It felt like not each song had its own identity. And so I'd be listening to a song and think, oh, this song is essentially the same as the song that was three tracks ago, you know, and I never feel that this album, Modern Vampires of the City, has that problem, like, ever.
Well, I mean, especially with those two albums you just mentioned, you know, we've had moments where we were, like, listening to it with other people, and it was like, this is the last song, right? Yeah. No, this is the last song. And it was, like, three songs from the end, and, you know, it felt like the album was ending there, but the album wasn't ending there, and that's something that's very different with Modern Vampires, because instead of just being, like, a bunch of songs, you know, and I don't mean to, like, criticize Humans or AM too harshly, because I do think they're both good albums, but their identity as an album isn't nearly as cohesive as Modern Vampires of the City, which makes it kind of a special album.
Is what, Caitlin, what you were describing, is that what really sets this particular... Because it sounds like you both are a fan of the band in general. Is that what sets this particular album out apart from all the others? And do you guys have a favorite song on this album?
So this album easily places within my top two albums of all time, just like I said earlier that Vampire Weekend plays into my top five artists of all time. This album, the band says that it's sort of the closing of a trilogy. This is their third album, and they definitely have evolved since they started their band back in the mid to late 2000s. And so their first album was very poppy and very, very easy to grasp, very easily accessible. And then their second album, less so, but you could tell that they were developing as a band with their style and their message. And then they roll into this album, which I feel was a very distinct shift from Contra, which still had a lot of that poppy elements to it. Even though it was a very distinct shift, you could still feel the progression from Vampire Weekend, the album, to Contra, and now into Modern Vampires of the City.
Yeah, kind of like you said, it has a lot more style and message than the two previous albums did, and then that a lot of albums do in general.
One thing that I think helped contribute to that is how the band recorded this album. For Vampire Weekend, the album, they had originally just written all the songs and then went into the recording studio and essentially just played their songs out, and then they left the recording studio and then did a little bit less of that in Contra. For Modern Vampires of the City, their methodology was more, we have an idea for a song, let's go into the recording studio and then play a song. It doesn't have to be the song we go in there with, but let's just record one and see how it feels.
Yeah, and to answer your question, Diana, Well, it's kind of interesting because this album doesn't make my top five, and it might not even make my top 10 of just albums, but I really appreciate how well constructed it is. And part of why it's not going to rate so highly for me is just because I would rather just kind of not really think about the messages carried throughout Modern Vampires, which include such things as feeling adrift and being lonely and questioning your faith. You know, like, those are the heavy topics that I don't mean to be dealing with. So it's hard for me to choose a favorite song, but it would probably be Step, I guess.
Yeah, to answer your question for me, Diana, because I never actually did it, my favorite song is also Step. Yeah, it's Step. Step, that's why I played it for you guys, because it is just a spectacular song. But since Caitlin talked about the themes a little bit of this album, I wanted to really dig into that. She was speaking about how this album sort of had a theme of wandering and uncertainty and self-exploration. And to me, it kind of felt like Ezra learning how to become an adult, you know, learning what it means to move on past college.
Yeah, I said quarter-life crisis yesterday, and quarter-life crisis isn't entirely correct, but it's kind of close.
Yeah, it's not entirely incorrect either. It's a very interesting album to listen to because on the surface, you know, a lot of these songs can feel pretty happy and enjoyable, but you start listening to them, and one song that is probably my second favorite on the album, Hannah Hunt, is about Ezra wandering around the country with this girl, essentially just bumming around and having a good time on the surface, but eventually he loses the girl and he has no purpose after that. He doesn't feel like there's anything for him to do. And so a lot of the album is him sort of addressing this feeling of wandering, which I don't resonate with, but I really appreciate it and could put myself into those shoes after, you know, really examining the album and figuring it out.
Yeah, and I guess that's the opposite of my issue with it, is that I immediately put myself in its shoes, and then the more I listen to it, the more I think about it, the further I can kind of step away in an artistic sense, instead of immediately being like, oh no, I am also adrift, like, because I'm fine. I mean, like, I have, like, the best job in the world. I'm fine, but it's an album that brings a lot, gives a lot, and asks a lot of you.
In terms of asking a lot of you, I no longer can listen to this album at work because I find when I do, I just kind of stop working for an hour because I just listen to the album. It's the only album off the top of my head that literally pulls me away from what I'm doing, and I stop and really listen to the album, even if I don't intend to start that way. That's what it devolves into.
Yeah, and as, you know, opposed, I listened to it 3 times straight through earlier today while I was just jamming through some data.
Jamming through that data.
Yeah.
So I don't want to make this album sound like it's all about, you know, this really pensive and low-key, and it's...
Yeah. No, because, like, Hannah Hunt is, like, such a gentle, pleasant song just to listen to, you know, on a superficial level. It's just... Once you think about a lot of the lyrics, you get kind of sad.
This album is indie pop, after all, and it definitely fills that role out. I mean, you heard with Diane Young, that was a very poppy song and just an awesome song. You know, definitely a summer hit when it came out. But the end of the album is a song called Young Lion. It's a very optimistic song at the end. There's one line repeated over and over again: take your time, young lion. I think that's it. And it's just repeated over and over again, sort of this closing message that's just like, you know, I've felt like I've been wandering recently. I, Ezra Koenig, in this, you know, in this scenario, mm-hmm. I felt like I've been wandering recently, and I've sort of been working myself out of that funk, and now it took a while, but I did it. And so it's sort of a message being like, if this album resonates with you, take your time with it. I don't like the song in particular, but the way that it leaves, the way that it works into the album itself is what really struck with me.
Yeah, and the way the album flows as a whole. But Carter, I want you to talk about the live shows.
Yeah, this is a good note to end on. I've seen Vampire Weekend twice in concert, once with Caitlin at a show in Charlottesville, and then one other time at Firefly Music Festival back 2013, I think.
2013.
It was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And we didn't touch on the religious aspect of this album because there absolutely is one. But it doesn't really connect with Caitlin or I in any particular way, so we didn't feel the need to comment on it.
Yeah.
But the song, I remember this one very vivid moment when I'm standing in the crowd. They're playing their set. It's on the Modern Vampires tour, and so they're playing all the big hits from that. And the back of the stage is to the sun. It's right at sunset, and during one of the songs, Ezra stops and takes like this spoken word interlude, and he talks about like the sun setting over the festival grounds, and it doesn't quite relate how, like, you know, it's not just like, yay, we're at this festival. It's kind of a quiet
poetic
poetic stanza, and it just like it the way that the song sort of takes a step back from itself and really just hits this really poetic moment, and the way that they had timed this song to do that just as the sun actually did go down, it was just this mind-blowing moment for me. It's really hard to describe, but like honestly one of the best show moments that I've ever experienced.
Yeah, and I have seen them twice. I saw them, I guess I've seen them for each album tour, twice in my hometown, and then once, you know, in Charlottesville with Carter, where we were both at. Yeah. And that was a Modern Vampires show? I don't know. They were just kind of there.
It was 2014, so they were just kind of riding that the end of that tour.
Yeah. But the first two times I saw them in, I guess, early and late high school, I don't know, or middle school even. I still have like really vivid sense memories from that tour of it being one of the first times where I like understood the appeal of live music, and it was like a special, you know, moment with me and my dad, like just having fun, you know, like just that. It was summer and it was so warm outside and you could smell the grass, and I just remember at the end of the second tour when we were, you know, waiting to get out of the Meriwether Post Pavilion, just sitting there and like listening to the album over again because Vampire Weekend is that good that we had just left a Vampire Weekend concert and queued up more Vampire Weekend, and just being like very happy and being so glad that my dad was driving and I wasn't. And I don't know, I think they're a special band that they can still have that strong of a sense memory for something so incidental as like, I'm glad I'm not driving, like, you know, but in a way that emotionally resonates. And even though this album isn't where I want to be right now, it's an amazing album, and it really is kind of the closing of the trilogy. You know, at first, let's see, there's a quote from Ezra Koenig where he says, "The naive, joyous school days in the beginning, then the expansion of the world, travel, seeing other places, learning a bit more about how people live, and then the end is a little bit of growing up, starting to think more about your life and your faith. If people could look at our three albums as a Bildungsroman," I can't speak German anymore, "I'd be okay with that." And I really feel like that's a good way to sum up the three Vampire Weekend albums thus far.
Very poetic, very like poignantly poetic.
That's the kind of dude he is, yeah.
Yeah. Also super pretentious.
Super pretentious. Cannot forget this. Oh, and here's a fun fact to lead with. So Ezra Koenig watched The Lost Boys and then was like, awesome, what if this was East Coast, and tried to film like a recreation of The Lost Boys in like his childhood town.
No.
And he gave up on it after 2 days, but he liked the name Vampire Weekend enough to bring it back for something else.
That's hilarious.
I think that's gonna be all we've got for Vampire Weekend.
All right. Really loved hearing you guys talk about music that you enjoy. So on that, we're going to move to a break. Hi, and welcome back to Brought to the Table after our break. Coming up now, we've got Diana and Ian, who are also going to talk about music. Diana or Ian, do you want to bring us in?
Yeah, so today Ian and I are going to be talking about a band that we both really love and we have both been following for a very long time. We are talking about Panic! Exclamation point at the Disco. And so Panic! At the Disco is a rock and alternative band. It's kind of classified as both. It was formed in 2004, and the original lineup included Brendan Urie, Ryan Ross, Spencer Smith, and Brent Wilson. But pretty much all of those people, except for Brendan Urie, have left the band for varying reasons. So right now, Panic at the Disco is basically Brendan Urie with an accompaniment of tour, usually for tours and stuff. He is accompanied by various people on guitar and drums, and sometimes he has brass instruments. And so originally it started as a Blink-182 cover band, of all things. How they got discovered was they actually sent a tape to Pete Wentz, who is the bassist for Fall Out Boy, and he pretty much signed them to Fueled by Ramen, which is also owned by Patrick Stump, who's also with Fall Out Boy. And pretty much right after they were signed, their first album, A Fever You Can't Sweat Out, came out.
So just real quick, they got signed to DK Dance Records, which that's the one that's owned by Pete Wentz and Patrick Stump. DK Dance Records is underneath Fueled by Ramen.
And they are currently under, they're still under Fueled by Ramen today.
Yes, yeah.
And so right now, Brendan Urie pretty much does almost everything for the band. He is accompanied by wonderful artists, but he is pretty much the band right now. The albums that they have out in order is, well, actually, they only have a couple albums out, which is A Fever You Can't Sweat Out, pretty odd, Vices and Virtues, Too Weird to Live, Too Rare to Die, and Death of a Bachelor. But actually, like, literally a few days ago, as of this recording, they announced their brand new album to come out on June 22nd called Pray for the Wicked. And right now they have two songs and one music video released for it. And they're both so promising and so good for the rest of this album.
Which I've only listened to the first one, which is Say Amen. And hands down, it is amazing. And I am just so fucking excited to just see where they go with the rest of this album just from that one song. I haven't even listened to the second one yet, which was, what was the other one, Diana? I'm horrible with names.
It was Fuck a Silver Lining.
That's right.
Like, also really good. Both are available in general music stores and iTunes.
So, do you want to go into how you got into it?
Yeah, so, I'll be honest, my brother got me into this band. My brother went through his, like, I'm a teenager emo phase. And at the time when Panic at the Disco, their first album, was very much in that kind of teenage-ish genre. And so, Caitlin, I thought it was really cool that you were saying that with the album you guys were talking about, how you could kind of see this journey in growing up, because when I was looking at the different albums and comparing songs, you can also kind of see that with Panic at the Disco, except for the fact that you narrow it down to one guy and he's like, we're going to take it in this direction. But A Fever You Can't Sweat Out was the first album I listened to. I listened to a couple songs on there. They were pretty iconic from my childhood. And I didn't think too much of it. I heard they weren't very good live, so I didn't really get too into it because I was kind of disappointed about that. And then actually a year or two ago, my roommate, who is also Ian's roommate, started listening to Death of a Bachelor when it came out, which is a really long jump. And he was just obsessively playing Death of a Bachelor, and I started really listening to this. He would literally sing in the shower. Thank God Connor can sing. Because otherwise,
my room was right across from the shower. I heard it nonstop for months.
And so I really fell in love with Death of a Bachelor. And actually, if you guys want to take like 20 seconds to like play the video I sent you.
Lace in your dress tingles my neck. How do I live?
Much of a Sinatra fan, but like, holy shit, this is just good.
So I picked this song as the song I really wanted to talk about because I think it explains why I really love the band and Brendan Urie so much right now, is because he is a really fabulous vocalist and songwriter, and he really puts so much passion and joy and thought into almost every single lyric and music video and piece and part, and there's just so much quality in everything being thought out. And I thought this song, which is the title of my favorite album, Death of a Bachelor, really explored this just wonderful vocal range that he has and that you can really appreciate. And it's such a unique sound and style for a band that started out with kind of generic-y pop and rock and alternative, and has come such a long way that they're experimenting in jazz now. Like, there's some solid trumpets in that song, and I can just appreciate it so much, and it's so wonderful to listen to. And really, this album is just a fabulous story of a crazy night, stage by stage. You have these really amazing ups and downs, and you start the night with this kind of like hype song and victorious, and then you kind of go through the night and you can kind of just follow this really wild, crazy night in one album. And so listening to each song back to back to back is really wonderful. Yeah, and so that's why I really picked this song in particular to explain exactly why I love this band so much.
Which, like, where you're coming from, where it's an entire story within just that album, that's one of my favorite things about, you know, Panic at the Disco as a band in and of itself. Like you touched on earlier, you can follow their progression, but even then, it's essentially you're watching an individual. Like, this entire band is one entity, and you are watching it progress and grow. And you can follow as it changes. Like, every album, you can just see it kind of leading into the other. It's a similar sort of familiar feeling at the core, but, like, its expression and the life in it just goes in different ways each album. But you can still just, like, relate it to each other. Whereas I feel like a lot of other bands, you know, not to throw anything bad at Linkin Park. I love Linkin Park. I felt like they came out with their newer albums and it sounds nothing like, you know, Hybrid Theory or Midoriya. It didn't sound like any of those. And it just had this huge sort of split between what they were and where they are now. But like with Panic, you have that consistent sort of transformation throughout all of their albums. And to me, that's impressive and very hard to do, I feel, if you're changing the style each album. But then, like, to actually tie in storylines, like with This Is Gospel from Too Weird to Live, Too Rare to Die, where it starts with, like, the music video is Brendan Urie being, like, operated on or being tied down by doctors, is essentially the story. Like, the music video is him being buried and him dying. And then they pick up with that with Emperor's New Clothes in Death of a Bachelor. And that starts with the music video having it to where Brendan Urie is like starting to go up towards heaven and then drops through a floor, lands in hell, and becomes a literal demon who at the end of the song is fully done up with like 100% to the tops makeup and prosthetics and has like actual like angel looking wings that have been burnt and singed, it looks like, and he's coming back up from hell. And it's like, that is impressive just to have a like multi-album storyline. And I really, really hope that they tie this, like that same storyline, somehow into this new album, Pray for the Wicked. Because with a name like that, come on, you just you just gotta, especially with Say Amen, the one song that I saw the music video for. It starts with an item called the Devil's Key. I mean, it's, I'm just really hoping they do more with that.
Yeah, and I mean, I really like how they tied together those two music videos. You know, that's not something you see all that often. But I don't know. I listened to A Fever You Can't Sweat Out and Pretty Odd, like, obsessively, but part of why I did that was because they were so different, you know? So, well, okay, I feel like actually just Pretty Odd is the stepchild, you know?
It is very different from where they are in most of their other albums, but at the same time, I still feel like it fits in with all of them because every album has almost a different sort of style to it. Like, Fever is very much sort of the emo vaudeville electronic era. Come on, it is. And then Pretty Odd is very, it's very folksy, I feel. Like, it has that sort of, like, folksy, just upbeat and just happy sort of sound to it. And then you go into Vices and Virtues, and I really don't even know where I would classify that as. But, like, it's, each, what I'm getting at is, like, each album has its own distinctive genre or style that it's heading towards, but still remains at its core very, very much, hey, this is Panic.
I thought that Vices and Virtues and Too Weird were the same album for a while.
No, I feel you. Some of the, I know that, especially since I kind of
yeah,
jumped
I jumped
Fever
much like you did. So.
To, yeah, I jumped from Fever to Death of a Bachelor. And so when I got to, when I really got into Death of a Bachelor and I decided to get back to this band, I was like, oh man, I need to go back and really like re-listen to a lot of these other songs and albums that I missed, because, and that's actually how I also ran across a couple of Ian's favorite songs.
Oh, they're so good.
And it was just, I don't know, it was kind of fun. It was kind of like, it was really interesting to be able to do that kind of jump, because it was a really wild jump in style and genre and really quality. And so I go back and I just start re-going through all these albums again, and I'm just like, man, oh man.
So, as long as we're talking about our favorite Panic at the Disco songs, I absolutely love Death of a Bachelor, but, one song that kind of got overshadowed, yes, because it wasn't actually on an album, was the song Come On, which was a collaboration with the band Fun, because for the which album was it, for the Vices and Virtues tour, they actually toured with Fun. Fun was their opener, and so they put out this song, a collaboration with them, and it's just, oh my god, it is one of my favorite Panic at the Disco songs.
I jumped from Pretty Odd to Death of a Bachelor, and I was sad that I kind of just missed Come On.
Yeah, actually, in the Suicide Squad album for the movie, they actually do a cover of Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's just, oh god, of all the people who has the vocal range to really do that song justice, I feel like Brendan Urie does. Like, it's not as like high quality as like the original. But if
Freddie Mercury, but he's about as damn close as we're going to get.
Yeah, like, I feel like if anybody can do that song justice.
And they took that song on tour, didn't they?
Yeah, we actually saw that.
Oh, yeah.
So the concert that Diana, myself, and our other roommate at the time, Connor, went to, it was at Greensboro in North Carolina. And they actually did Bohemian Rhapsody there. And was hands down one of the best covers of that song that I have ever heard. And like, one of the other things that really stood out to me about that concert was just how much of a stage presence that they had. Diana had mentioned earlier on, and like whenever she was talking about how she was told that like they didn't have that good of a stage presence, or that their live concerts weren't all that good. I had never really gone to one of their concerts before. I'd gone to one earlier on in the year, but like it was way, way far back. The one that we went to, we were actually down in like the pit area, and just looking around and just seeing how many people were getting this into like the band performing, and then just watching Brendan Urie on stage. I don't know what it is, but it's very, very, I guess powerful is the only way I can explain it. He has a very good sense of how to interact with the crowd, how to keep the crowd hyped up and everything, but not to the point where it's just, you're not paying attention to anything. You're just not there in the moment. You're experiencing everything, but you're very aware of how good of a time this is. It was there at this concert that while they played what is probably my favorite song, second comes in at with This Is Gospel, but hands down, Girls, Girls, Boys is my favorite Panic song. They actually had a bunch of cut out paper hearts of different colors on each of the seats while you were there. And whenever that song came on, they wanted you to hold up the like paper heart in front of like a flashlight or something and like just wave it. And there's a recording, I had it somewhere that I'd saved from YouTube or something, of somebody actually showing the entire Colosseum where there's nothing but thousands of these lights that are just like different colored hearts. And just, it was done as a sort of support for like the LGBTQ groups. And it was just, it's amazing. Cause like the whole idea behind Girls, Girls, Boys, according to Brendon Urie, is it's a song about bisexuality and sort of, in a sense, kind of casual sex, which is an entirely larger topic that we could go on for hours. But I think the way that he was doing it was very much, hey, this is a thing. And this is an okay thing for people to feel this way. You're not a horrible person. You're not disgusting. You're not, you know, you're not, there's nothing wrong with you, which is something that very much resonates with me. And to be honest, like this song and a couple lines from This Is Gospel is a large part of the inspiration for like the first tattoo that I got. And so it's like really, really well done.
So I really liked how you guys wrapped up with concert memories, so we'll wrap up with that. I have two very strong memories, like sense memories, I guess, like Caitlin was describing them, from that particular concert. One of which is, so at one point Brendon Urie had gone to the middle of the stage and he was on a piano and he had gone in the middle of the crowd and he had played his song. And as he was singing the next one, he's walking by each of, and he's kind of high-fiving and shaking hands with everybody in the audience, and we were lucky that we got really good seats because of like a pre-sale and this and that. And so thank you, Ian, for blocking those middle schoolers from crushing me, because I could not have fought them off. I shook hands with Brendon Urie, and he's such a pure joy. And then additionally, the other really strong memory I have from that concert is, like Ian had said, during the Girls, Girls, Boys, it was just a really cool thing to see everybody kind of come together as a crowd and just this really wonderful kind of sense of community and just being able to kind of and being able to be there together. And I just kind of like looked over at Ian because I know this is his favorite song. And it was really wonderful because you looked so happy and you were just so happy and content in that one moment. And I was really happy to be able to look over and be like, my friend is truly happy in this moment. And I am so happy for him. And I just knew how much like he loved that song and how much that song meant to him and how much it connects in a live performance.
What she's trying to say without saying is that there were tears, because there were tears.
I mean, when we saw them and they played a song from Fever, I just started crying spontaneously.
I mean, like, that's the thing. You call me off for that. Like, I can't deny that. That's 100% understandable.
I wasn't going to be like, oh man, Ian cried. But at the same time, I have just never seen you so, like, I won't say emotional, but just, like, feeling the feels, I guess, in that one moment. And I was just like, it's really nice to see my friend being able to enjoy this moment fully.
Well, I appreciate it. It was a really great concert. So if anybody goes to the concerts or is thinking about it, do it.
Also, buy us tickets.
We would love you forever.
My love is very cheap, but you can have it.
But I think that's mostly what we really had on that.
That pretty much wraps up our undying love for this band and Brendon Urie, who is a gift upon us as human beings, and we need to do more to deserve him.
Oh, shit, I just realized Fever came out when I was in 8th grade.
Jesus, you're old.
Oh, my God.
It's nice hearing you guys talk about some of the depth of this band, because the only album that I listen to from them is Fever from middle school. And I still only listen to that album. It's good, but...
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a lot of people's, like, starting point. But, like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of us sort of had the same sort of experience with, like, starting with that and then stopping until Death of a Bachelor and then just jumping back in immediately from there and like listening to everything else.
I was in there for Pretty Odd, but yeah, I skipped the rest of it.
Joke's on y'all. I didn't listen to music as a child because I was weird, I guess. I started...
You were out in the country.
All right.
Was
wow.
weird?
Okay. All right. Bye, everybody. I guess I'm going to leave now.
All right, then.
Welcome to the last episode of Brought to the Table. We have appreciated all the time that everybody has been here for this.
Now that we've just had our big single dropping release, goodbye. Goodbye forever.
I guess, yeah, that wraps up this episode, which may or may not be the final episode of Brought to the Table.
Yeah, your editor's out.
Thanks for tuning in. As always, please check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, or our website, broughttothetable.com. If you're searching for us, we're Brought to the Table. And if you're looking on Twitter specifically, we are at To The Table Pod. We always appreciate comments, emails, whatever you want to do to get in contact with us. Thanks for listening to our special music-based segment.
Bye.
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 All right, everybody yell into your mic on three. One, two, three.
Blah! Blah!
All right, that should help Carter sync up the...
No, it really won't. It really will not.
Oh, my God.